The Missoula County Sheriff's Office concludes its investigation of a dog shot allegedly because a hunter thought it was a wolf. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce profiles a Democratic candidate for Montana's U.S. House seat who is critical of Senator Max Baucus's legacy. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a modern art curator about the genius of 20th century artists like Picasso and Matisse. The Missoula County Sheriff's Office has ended its investigation of a fatal shooting of a Malamute dog that was apparently mistaken for a wolf. Sheriff's spokeswoman Paige Pavallone says no criminal activity took place and the matter was handed over to Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks and the Forest Service. Lane Spence said he was skiing with his three dogs on a quiet logging road yesterday afternoon when he heard a shot and saw his dog, Little Dave, fall down with a leg injury. About 15 yards away, Spence said he saw a man wearing camouflage and carrying a gun. He says he screamed at the man to stop shooting, but he fired five more times. Spence says the man who allegedly shot his dog simply said, quote, "I thought it was a wolf," end quote, and asked if there was anything he could do. Pavallone says Spence was distraught and told the man to leave. Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks spokeswoman Vivica Krauser says hunters can never forget the most basic of safety rules, being sure of not only your target, but what lies beyond that target.
And this report, you know, and what happened in this situation clearly violates that one. And the list could go on, but that's one of the basic principles. And, you know, if that rule had been followed, this situation wouldn't have happened. Additionally, when you start to think about responsibilities of hunters and ethics and things like that, those are huge areas that we talk about in hunter education classes. And being responsible for mistakes or issues that happen when you're out there is a big one as an ethical hunter.
Krauser says lots of dog owners like to let their dogs off leash in the woods, which is fine if local regulations allow for that.
And so then the next thing you start to think about if you're out skiing with a dog that's off leash is how easily can I control my dog? Can I get it back? If it starts to get away from me, pick up a scent, any number of things that could put a risk to your dog out there. And so that's what we try to stress with folks that ask is just make sure you can keep your dog within and voice control.
She adds those off-leash adventures always carry a certain measure of risk.
There's potential for any number of things to happen out there. So, you know, it's kind of feeling comfortable with what level of risk you're going to assume. And there's things you can do to mitigate that, such as keeping your dog on leash or just knowing you can have it under voice control. During hunting season, we get asked a lot about, should I be wearing Hunter Orange if I'm not hunting? And should my pet also have it on? And again, it's kind of a comfort level, not something that's required, but just know you're sharing the space out there this time of year. And so some people opt to do that and others don't.
When Spence returned to town, he filed a complaint with the sheriff's office. That report was shared with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Krauser says while the situation is tragic, no criminal investigation is warranted.
And in other news from around the state, the Blackfeet Tribe's housing agency is suing the U.S. government for more than $1.2 million over damage to Browning homes that were flooded in 2011. The tribal agency says in its lawsuit that significant snow and rain that year left flooded basements and many of the tribal-owned rental homes. The lawsuit says an engineer determined the flooding was caused by clogged storm drains that caused the water to back up into houses south of U.S. Highway 2. The tribal agency says the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs is responsible for the storm drains, but they have not been maintained for years. The BIA responded Friday by saying the houses were built in a low-lying area and that Browning is responsible for the drainage system.
A Missoula rider is announcing her run for Montana's lone U.S. House seat. Democrat Melinda Gopher ran for the seat in 2010, coming in third in the Democratic primary. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us she is running a campaign focused on bucking the Democratic establishment.
What I do believe is that we have a power elite that has abused the Indian vote for a long time in the state.
Candidate Melinda Gopher is an enrolled member of the Blackfeet tribe.
And that power elite has been led by Senator Baucus.
She faults Senator Baucus's legacy for a number of reasons, but most vocally for his involvement as a chief architect of the Affordable Care Act.
It was legislation that was short-sighted, and it was written by the health insurance industry.
Gopher announced her House bid on social media last week. Her complaints about the Affordable Care Act have already been seized upon by the GOP. The National Republican Congressional Committee put out a press release saying Gopher is taking a stand and speaking out against the Obamacare train wreck. But Gopher's views on healthcare actually come from much further on the left than Obamacare. She wants universal healthcare, a single-payer system, which she says has been shown to produce better health outcomes at lower costs in other countries. Gopher also faults her only Democratic primary opponent so far for his ties to Senator Baucus. John Lewis was a longtime Baucus staffer, most recently serving as the senator's state director before leaving to focus on his House campaign.
There's kind of a stain of incumbency on him.
Lewis has a lot of financial and political support for his bid, but Gopher believes voters understand different voices are needed in Congress to effect real change. Gopher says she's educated as a paralegal and has spent most of her career in the nonprofit sector. She says she now works full-time as a writer. She lists addressing climate change as a top priority.
Our energy policy shouldn't mean fracking every available inch of this nation.
Gopher believes the fossil fuel industry should be taxed at a greater rate to create more investments in renewable energy.
No one in Washington seems to be willing to do that, including the Obama administration, including our own representatives here in Montana. They're happy to go along to get along.
Gopher says she supports former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger in his run for U.S. Senate. She says Bollinger's main Democratic challenger, current Lieutenant Governor John Walsh, is too tied in with the Democratic powers that be, like Senator Baucus. She also applauds Bollinger for being a part of the Schweitzer administration, which she says was a great friend of Indian country. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The State Board of Regents is meeting in Bozeman later this week in part to discuss ways to increase enrollment in graduation rates. During the meeting Thursday and Friday, Regents are expected to give Montana State University authorization to spend $60 million to build a new residence hall and improve the dining halls at three other dorms. MSU is also seeking $10 million in short-term bonds to complete the new College of Business building, which could be repaid over 5 years with donations from MSU alumni Jake's Jabs. Regents are also scheduled to discuss the Complete College Montana program, which seeks to increase the number of Montanans with a college degree or certificate from 40% to 60% and ties some state funding to student progress.
The state says its land holdings generated almost $120 million for the school trust over the past year. The Montana Land Board manages more than 5 million acres of land and a slightly larger area in mineral rights. The board is run by the five statewide elected officials from the governor on down. The money it generates with land leases, logging, and other activities goes to a trust used to help pay for schools. Annual revenues have increased from about $80 million in 2004. The Department of Natural Resources and Conservation told the board today that its holdings are now worth roughly $2.6 billion. It said the value of its agricultural land has been increasing in recent years. About 8% of state school budgets come from the land trust.
No museum in the country has been more instrumental in introducing modern Impressionist art to American audiences than the Art Institute of Chicago. The Institute's Gary C. and Francis Comer Curator of Modern Art is in Missoula to lecture about a seminal show in 1913 that introduced the greats like Picasso and Matisse to this country. Stephanie D'Alessandro's talk coincides with a current exhibit of modern art, including works by Picasso and Matisse, at the Montana Museum of Art and Culture at the University of Montana campus. In this feature interview, news director Sally Mock tours the exhibit with D'Alessandro, who describes the importance in 1913 of what was called the Armory Show.
It's kind of, you know, the United States' first blockbuster exhibition. It happened in New York first, and it's called the International Exhibition of Art, of Modern Art, but it came to be known as the Armory Show because it was shown in an armory. It was so big. There were nearly 1,500 works in the show that introduced American audiences to European avant-garde art and some American avant-garde art, Picasso, Matisse, for example, Duchamp, all these artists today who we know as the great modernists of our time. And it was the first time that Americans had ever seen them. But the show traveled to Chicago and also to Boston, and the Art Institute has the special honor of being the only museum to have hosted the show. So it also is the only museum in the country, or the first museum in the country, to show Picasso, for example, to American museum audiences. And it really set a course afterwards. It sort of sparked a flame for modern art in the United States. States. So while the actual story of the Armory Show may not be very well known to many of us today, it has really important implications for how we know modern art today in the United States.
And how was it received at the time? Was it seen as something revolutionary but wonderful, or was it seen as something that people had skepticism about?
I think it was everything. I mean, the works themselves were not all of them were really that avant-garde. There were representational, naturalistic works that were there, works that were in a very pleasing kind of impressionist vein. But there were, very radical works there as well. There was one work by Marcel Duchamp, who is one of the great innovators of the 20th century, and he made a work called Nude Descending a Staircase, almost a play on impressionist interest in broken brushstrokes and a sense of movement from light. And it's a kind of stop motion, almost kind of painting of a nude in a cubist kind of look, kind of descending a staircase. And the picture was in many ways, the subject of many, many parodies and satires from New York to Chicago to Boston. And whether it was an exhibition that inspired true art lovers at the time or inspired people's curiosity and humor, I think that's part of what made the exhibition so important.
And the Art Institute of Chicago, I read, has the largest collection of Impressionist art outside of Paris.
The Art Institute was founded in 1873, I think, and was a very, very small institution. And the city itself grew as the museum grew. And the people who were the founders of the museum were very interested in what was new at the time because the city was new. And in 1893, when we had the World Columbian Exposition, it was really a fair that celebrated the rebirth of the city after the fire. And there was an exhibition of art there that was contemporary French art that happened to be Impressionism. And so these young collectors, new collectors, who didn't want to collect old master paintings for the Art Institute, were really inspired by the art that they saw there. They saw something about this new painting and this new city, this rebirth of the city, we'll say. And it really became a very important style for them. Mrs. Potter Palmer was one of the people who was so inspired that she became friends with Monet. She acquired many, many works from him. She had a Renoir that she actually took with her wherever she traveled. It was in her train car. It went to her hotel room afterwards. This is an extraordinary kind of experience. And a lot of those collectors gave their works to the Art Institute. So we do have a very rich collection because of that great history.
Talk a bit about the role of patronage in art, because it's crucial, isn't it? And it's something that doesn't get as much attention sometimes, like this exhibit here. It's made possible by patrons and collectors and so on.
It's very, very important. I think especially today in the United States, so many arts institutions are so embattled. There's so many things that are important for funding, whether it's education or healthcare, that it's hard sometimes for people to understand, I think, why the arts deserve people's attention and support. And this exhibition is a great example of the generosity of a collector to make some really amazing works available for people to see. And I think that there's a lot to be said in an age when emails make us move very quickly and we see so much digitally, to take a moment and look at artworks where we have to take some time to look in a different pace and see something that's handmade. And I just think that there's just no substitute when you see the real thing. It's just not the same. There's no competition with something on the internet.
Well, let's take some time and look at some of the art here. I wanted to start with this Picasso, and this is a portrait of Olga, and this was done in 1923, and not a painting that I think a lot of people might associate with later Picasso, certainly.
It's a very interesting painting. I mean, first of all, there's always for Picasso the story of Picasso and his women, whether it was Fernand, his first artistic muse, or his first wife, Olga, all the way through. I mean, the man had a very long life and had lots of relationships with lots of women. And I think one reason why we're fascinated by them is because for Picasso, he put so much into those women. They become his muses, his inspiration, and they become the subjects of his works over and over. They become almost like clay or something that he molds and shapes as he kind of comes to different styles. And Olga is a very important person in Picasso's life because she meets him at the time when he is sort of, he's done cubism, he's become known as this leader of this avant-garde style, along with George Braque. And in 1917, he goes to Italy. He has a commission to work on the ballet Parade, and he is traveling in Italy. It's the first time he's ever been to Rome. He sees Baroque art, Renaissance art, ancient Greek and Roman art. He goes to Pompeii. He sees things he has never seen before. And mixed with the end of World War I, at a time when artists were sort of thinking about a need for a return to order after all that destruction, and perhaps an artistic style that was destructive, cubism, there was an interest in returning to something more eternal, something more recognizable, something more peaceful. For Picasso and other artists, it's what they call a retour à l'ordre, or a return to order, a neoclassical style that Picasso begins to develop at the same time that he meets Olga. And so we're looking at this very small, very intimate, very beautiful, I think very delicately painted portrait of Picasso's first wife, made at the period of time when he has a new kind of stability in his life. He has a son with Olga, and we see him painting in a very naturalistic style. This is not Picasso the Cubist, though he still is making Cubist art at this time. And it's a remarkable picture because if you get up really close and you look at it, you'll see that he has sort of sketched her. You can watch how he's started to lay paint in around the shape of the eyes as if he's almost using the paint like clay to sort of model the surface of her face. Her hair is very delicately painted. It's a very, very, as I said, intimate, I think, painting of this woman who means so much to him.
I love the gaze. There's a hint of sadness to her eyes, but also just such a thoughtful look.
Mm-hmm. Very introspective, I think.
Let's look at a later Picasso. This was done in 1956.
A very, very different Picasso at this point. And we're looking, ironically, at Picasso's other wife. Now, this is Jacqueline. After Olga passes away, Picasso is free to marry and has met this wonderful woman, Jacqueline, who brings Picasso a great amount of peace at the end of his life. And he meets her at a moment when he's working in the south of France after World War II. He, in the south of France, has the opportunity to rediscover the ceramics industry there, which is a kind of dying industry when he first meets the people who work there, one of whom is Jacqueline, his second wife. And he starts a kind of collaboration with the Madura Pottery firm and begins to paint on the ceramics there, very traditional forms that he finds and decorates. And you can see in this painting not only this portrait of a woman, but the influence of that experience in his painting now. So there's a beautiful sort of decorative quality, I think, in the way that he paints, especially Jacqueline's form. It's very, very spare, but there's just enough there that we can recognize her profile and see her body. What's interesting is that all the area of her face and her arms, for example, there's not actually that much paint there. He's sort of encompass the blank canvas or the spare canvas with these simple lines, very decorative lines, like he might have painted on a ceramic. And she is sort of one half of the canvas. The other half of the canvas is a painting by Picasso that Jacqueline is actually looking at. And we see this kind of interior space, the artist's studio, this beautiful kind of window and this palm tree outside, and then a canvas standing on an easel and a sculpture on the side, and the canvas is blank. There's a beautiful kind of light that's coming in that hits the floor. And it's a painting, I think, so much about negative and positive space and what's painted and what's not. And as a kind of, I think, a parting shot, Picasso actually went into the wet paint. You can see in the top of the easel, for example, and on the side, that kind of decorative figure. And he actually took, maybe it was the back of his brush or a palette knife or something, and actually scraped the paint out. So we're watching him remove paint in a kind of further play off the negative spaces that aren't painted in the picture. It's a remarkable, very quick, actually, quickly painted picture, but I think one that shows a lot of creativity.
Picasso was so prolific, of course, but what explains why he is known as the greatest artist? I mean, the most well-known.
I think one reason why he's known so much in the 20th century is because he was very prolific. And unlike other artists, you might think about like Matisse, for example, who's also right up there. Picasso, if he was painting a picture like this and decided that there was another way to do it, he'd just pick up another canvas and make another picture. Whereas Matisse would start to work on a picture like this, decide it wasn't right, wash it down, and start over again. Picasso is very quick. I think he had a sense of experimentation, and he was very interested in his process. I mean, very aware of his process of creation, and allowed lots of things to be kind of not finished in a certain way. Like Matisse would labor over something and look for the most perfect expression. Picasso would say, well, that's one variation. I'm going to try it another way. So he produced a lot of work. But I think he's also very well respected because he had a wide range of styles. And even in this exhibition, you'll see two great versions of neoclassicism and also, you know, still in the vein in the 50s of cubism. And he could very comfortably, in the same day even, produced pictures in two different styles. And that's what I think makes him so special, is that he really did have a great artistic skill and a great level of creativity.
I want to go back to something you said earlier about how much different it is to see the painting in person.
Yeah.
And to go to the exhibit and have the personal experience. It is so much more personal than seeing it online, for example.
I think so. I mean, when I look at a picture, I always first sort of just look at the image itself, but I always try to take the time to, once I can figure out maybe what the subject is or what pleases me or what's intriguing about it, always take the time to look at the paint strokes and the way that something is made, because it's you always have to remember that a person made this and there was nothing on that canvas in the beginning. And that's where I think, just like when a musical, a piece of music is performed, that's where the true invention is. The moment when an artist puts that brush on the canvas, or a palette knife in the case of Picasso, and you can't see that when you look at something on the screen. It's just not there.
Well, what a treat to look at these paintings with an expert. And I have been speaking with Stephanie D'Alessandro, who's a curator of art at the Art Institute of Chicago. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here today.
Stephanie D'Alessandro will give a free public lecture on Picasso, Matisse, and the 1913 Armory Show tonight at 8 o'clock in the University Center Ballroom on the University of Montana campus. The current exhibit of modern art by Picasso, Chagall, Matisse, and others runs through February 8th in the PacSun and Malloy Galleries on the UM campus.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, rain is likely with lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow, rain remains likely with highs in the 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect until 8 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front, as well as central and southern Lewis and Clark County. There is also a winter weather advisory in effect until 5 a.m. Wednesday for elevations above 5,000 feet for the northern Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight in central Montana, it should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain, freezing rain, and snow showers. Expect lows 25 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of light freezing rain in the morning, then a chance of rain and snow showers through the day. Expect highs in the 40s. Wind gusts could reach up to 40 miles per hour. Southwest Montana tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow, look for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the day, a slight chance of rain showers in the afternoon, and highs 40 to 50 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
If the Obama administration cannot get the incompetent, stumbling rollout of the Affordable Care Act fixed in the next month or so, we will soon face another game of economic chicken between Tea Party Republicans and President Obama. The settlement in October that ended the federal government shutdown and dodged the default of U.S. Treasury on American bonds settled none of the issues. It simply kicked the can down the road a few months when the Tea Party minority of Republicans will again seek to hold the nation's economy hostage in order to force the President and the Senate to approve the Tea Party's legislative agenda. This destructive tactic will be used again because the Tea Party stands no chance of mobilizing a majority vote to pass it through the normal constitutional channels. The October federal government shutdown and near federal default on its bonds embarrassed the Republicans and demonstrated the dangerous and destructive intentions of the Tea Party. By most accounts, this significantly damaged the Republican brand as it prepared for next year's midterm elections. The national press was full of stories about the Republicans' radical drift to the right as a result of the civil war within the GOP. The far-right minority in the party seems to have agreed on a suicide pact to take down the Republican Party as well as the national economy if they could not get their way. With Obama currently stumbling badly as a result of the embarrassing rollout of the Affordable Care Act, the Tea Party and Republicans are bound to be emboldened in the next battle over funding the federal government and keeping the U.S. Treasury from defaulting on American bonds. We may be back to where we were in October, with Republicans again demanding the abandonment of the Affordable Care Act in return for not destroying the nation's credit rating and pitching the world economy into chaos. The accompanying shutdown of the federal government may be a minor event compared to that likely international economic crisis. Since it is highly likely that we're going to face that game of economic chicken and political blackmail again, it is worth going back over some of the facts associated with the debt ceiling and the federal deficit. It is important to remember that the U.S. government has had a debt every year of its existence, except for one year in the early 1800s. The federal government came into existence with the debts associated with our Revolutionary War, carrying that and other debt almost continuously over the centuries, certainly did not keep the American economy from growing into the largest and most productive economy in the world that supported one of the highest standards of living in the world. The governments of other developed countries and their economies also carry significant debts. Strangely enough, the U.S. debt ceiling was originally adopted at the beginning of America's involvement in World War I to make it easier for the federal government to borrow money to prosecute the war effort without having to repeatedly go back to Congress for a second authorization for already approved war spending. The current budget ceiling legislation, however, creates the possibility of a contradiction in congressional mandates to the executive branch of government. When Congress passes legislation funding a program, it is ordering the president to operate that program by spending that money. But if the debt ceiling is not raised, Congress is also ordering the president not to fund that program, even though Congress has ordered that it be funded. Which order from Congress is the president supposed to break? From 1979 till 1995, Congress avoided this contradiction by adopting a rule that said that when a budget was passed by Congress, the debt ceiling was deemed to have been increased to accommodate that budget. A separate debt ceiling vote was not required. That would appear to be a politically more honest approach to controlling the national debt. Since 1940, it's estimated that the U.S. debt ceiling has been increased over 90 times. Republican presidents were in office for 54 of those increases, Democratic presidents for 40 of the increases. The cumulative amount of the debt increases, however, were larger under Democratic presidents. When Ronald Reagan, an enthusiastic small government advocate, was in office, the debt ceiling was increased a record 18 times. Obama so far has supported only 6 increases, a third as many. Bush the younger supported 7 increases and his dad 9 increases. Nixon supported 8 increases before he resigned in his second term. But Clinton, who balanced the federal budget, supported only 6 debt increases. Carter and LBJ each supported 10 increases. For almost all of those 90-plus debt ceiling increases, there was no effort at economic blackmail by either party. Most of the time, Congress respected the fact that it and no one else had ordered the spending that required the debt limit to be increased. The thinking was that it would be unethical for Congress to order that spending and then vote after the fact against paying the bill for what Congress had ordered. The contemporary Tea Party Republicans, however, have no such ethical qualms. There is something ironic, if not moronic, about folks who cloak themselves in the mantle of patriotism, threatening to permanently damage the American economy and America's standing in the world. Holding the nation's financial position hostage while engaging in economic blackmail is hardly the stuff of patriotism. It is the opposite.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.r.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Valentine. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.